It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. In Pittsburgh's large and diverse musical community, few, if any, artists are as widely known or as beloved as guitarist Joe Negri. Joe has appeared with Tony Bennett, Yo-Yo Ma, John Williams, Branford, and Winston Marsalis. But to many, he'll always be Handyman Negri, and he's still playing at age 92. On a recent afternoon, Joe spent some time between classes teaching young guitarists at the University of Pittsburgh to visit with his friend, 90.5 WESA's Bob Studebaker.
Joe, since your widest exposure has been through being Handyman Negri on the Mr. Rogers Neighborhood, I thought we'd go ahead and start there with his theme song, which you did a recording of for your album Uptown Elegance. Can you tell me a little bit about your relationship with Fred Rogers?
Well, my relationship with Fred goes back way before he ever started the neighborhood. Actually, he got a chance to come to WTAE, where I was musical director, and we put together a 15-minute version of the neighborhood show, where he actually opened up in his little apartment room with his piano. And then we went via the trolley into the neighborhood, which was very much like the new neighborhood turned out to be. And the station said, well, Joe, why don't you just help Fred out? If he needs a little background music, you know, you can supply it to the show. So one day Fred said to me, Joe, why don't you just walk around the neighborhood and talk to some of the puppets? So that's how I got acquainted. I talked to King Friday, and I talked to X the Owl, and I talked to Henrietta and Daniel, and I got to know all of them. So it's a long story short, but he lost the show at TAE because of his reluctance to be commercial. Typical Fred, you know. He wouldn't sell products, and he wouldn't do certain things like G.I. Joe and cereal with sugar in it, you know. And so, of course, can you imagine him in the sales department? They were at each other's throats. So eventually he left. And about a year later, he called me about the new show, wanted to know if I wanted to be the handyman, which was really another joke, because I said, really, you know, you got to be kidding, because I'm not very handy. He said, it'll just be pretend.
And you were in that neighborhood for nearly 40 years, becoming a pretty important part of the childhoods of generations of kids all across the country. But for me, for thousands of Pittsburgh kids who were in elementary school in the early 60s, it was Paul Shannon's Adventure Time, with its live studio audience of Cub Scouts and Brownies and the Three Stooges, that introduced us to Joe Negri.
Oh, Paul Shannon's Adventure Time, that was wonderful. That was something that came by because I was working at WTAE. I think they put me on, I don't know why they did that. They put me on children's shows. I must have had something like that. So I used to do a show called Popeye and Friends. And then when Paul would take a vacation, I'd do 2 weeks of the Shannon show, Adventure Time. And then one of the producers, I can't even remember his name, he said to me, Joe, why don't you try saying hello to all the people, all the Boy or Girl Scouts in the audience. So for some crazy reason, Bob, I started memorizing their names, Bob, Mary, Jane, Pete, and I would say hi to all of them. And it got to be so funny that the kids, believe it or not, would switch places on me to mess me up.
And for people who don't know, Paul Shannon's Adventure Time was on at 4 o'clock in the afternoons. We would hurry home from school because we saw Paul, we saw the Three Stooges, which were a revelation to kids in the 60s because the Three Stooges were from the 30s and early 40s, and what they produced then just sat and gathered dust until local TV shows across the country, prominently Paul Shannon and Adventure Time, started introducing them to a new audience, and you were there, and you had your guitar, and it was one of the first times I heard a jazz guitar, and I thought, I didn't understand what it was, but I knew I liked it better than other things I was hearing.
You know what was really funny? After I met Fred, and I was still doing the cartoon shows, Fred would say to me, "Oh, Joe, don't do that, Paul Shannon. Don't do that." Don't do that Stooges stuff. And when you're doing Popeye and Friends, if somebody takes a telephone pole and hits somebody on the head, stop, put yourself in the picture and say, no, don't do that. I said, Fred, I can't do that. The producer won't let me.
And I can add that mothers all across Pittsburgh and probably all across the country were not happy their kids were watching the Three Stooges. So while you were a part of that generation of creative people who pretty much invented the new medium of television in the 50s and 60s, at your core, you're a musician, a jazz musician. I'd like to ask about the way you play. Jazz is often improvised music, something that even highly trained classical musicians that I've talked to often find intimidating. What's your preference, a set arrangement or improvisation?
You know, I've gotten very, very much interested in solo guitar, and I've been writing a lot of things. So if I have to play something from my solo collection, then I'll play it as it was written. But normally, if I'm going to play for you, like... Sorry. I'm just improvising.
Here's that rainy day.
Yeah.
As we record on a rainy day. You prefer improvisation. I was just curious about that. Joe, you started really young, late 1920s, early 30s. No TV then, just radio. In a lot of ways, a different world.
I grew up in a time when there was a lot of children's performers going on. I don't know if you ever watched Steve Harvey now. He has a program on where he features young kids. Well, it was sort of like that back in the day. And there was a show here in Pittsburgh called Pittsburgh on Parade, and it featured young talent. I must have been 3 or 4 years old when I started. And I used to work on radio stations on uncle shows, Uncle Henry, Uncle Harry, Uncle Sammy, you know, and do a song or two, which was really interesting because when you think back, I'm learning songs like, Will I Ever Find the Girl on My Mind, the One Who Is My Ideal? You know, songs from the 30s, which were wonderful, beautiful American songbook songs. So my mother would teach me the lyrics, and my dad would kind of teach me the melody. And I think by the time I was before 5, he got a ukulele and put the ukulele in my hands, so I didn't have to depend on the piano player anymore. I could start accompanying myself with the uke. And that's where it began, Bob, you know. About 2 or 3 years later, the guitar got into the picture. And by the time I was 8, my dad sent me to a guy named Victor Lawrence, who wound up at Volkwines. I don't know, you remember that was our famous music store. So then Vic moved out, and he started a store which is still in Castle Shannon, and it's still called Lawrence Music. And they're good buddies of mine. And they bought the store from Vic Lawrence. And he was a great guitar teacher. He taught me a lot about the fingerboard and chords and a lot about like what the early guitar players played, you know.
I know that your formal education was at Carnegie Tech, now Carnegie Mellon University, and that pianist Johnny Costa, who years later worked with you on Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, recommended that you go there. Can you talk a little bit about that?
And Johnny said, well, why don't you come out to Carnegie Mellon? I said, I don't think they recognize this guitar. And he said, well, maybe you can do something else. He said, why don't you meet the composition teacher? His name was Nikolai Lopotnikov. And he was really a very nice guy from Russia. So I said, okay. So I went out and I met Nikolai. And he said to me, the first thing was, why don't you write me something? And we'll give it a shot, you know. So I went back, and I still have the composition somewhere in my drawer. And it was a very pretty melodic kind of a piano thing, melody. I took it to Nikolai, and he said, "Boy, you have a gift for melody." And he took me on as a student. So as far as the guitar, to end up, you know, to finish the story, they said, you have to minor in something, so I minored in string bass. And I knew a little bit about it. I never became a bass player.
So you majored in composition there and had to study bass because they, at that time, didn't think that The guitar was worthy of inclusion in a prestigious music program, but some of your education also happened at the Black Musicians Club, which was part of the Black Musicians Union. Until the mid-60s, there were two musicians unions in town, the white local, Local 60, and then Local 471, the Black Musicians Union, which was the incubator for generations of Pittsburgh artists who went on to be major figures in American music, people like Errol Garner, Stanley Turrentine, Roy Eldridge, Ahmad Jamal. What was it like there?
It always felt like, I don't know if this is describing it right, but it felt super hip, very hip. I felt like, boy, I was in the right place. The music was right. The people were terrific. I got to meet the bass player that I spent a lot of years with, Bobby Boswell. People like that, just wonderful, wonderful guys. I got to know Walt Harper very well. We became good friends. You know, I think I had more friends up there than I had down at RU in the Local 60.
And you learned jazz there in a way no other place could have taught you. So fast-forwarding to today, you've now taught a couple of generations of guitarists, and that started with a call from the Pitt Music School in the very early 70s.
I jumped at the idea, and I thought it was terrific, and I came over and began. I must have had maybe three or four or five students to begin with. A year later, I get a call from Duquesne, and they want to start a jazz guitar program, so I started down there. And about the same time, would you believe it, Carnegie Mellon called. So in the beginning, I was kind of busy. I must have had six or seven at Pitt, four or five at Duquesne, and two or three from Carnegie Mellon.
So what was your approach to teaching? How did you go about it?
I think I used Vic Lawrence's approach, which I have put together on my own. I call it a visualization of the fingerboard. So I teach that all to my kids, plus how to improvise, and I teach them how to play some solo guitar things.
Joe, I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me, and it's always great catching up with you again. It's been a while since I've seen you, and it's been wonderful to spend some time with you.
It's great to talk to you all the time. You're one of the gems for all jazz musicians. You really are.
Thanks, man. That's a humbling thing. Joe Negri, ladies and gentlemen, an absolute Pittsburgh legend. For The Confluence, I'm Bob Studebaker, 90.5 WESA.
Still to come on The Confluence, the quality of our urban soil impacts everything from public health to stormwater management to urban agriculture. We'll find out how this affects current and future environmental challenges. With troubles at the top at Tesla, can they deliver on the cars they've promised? The competition is heating up in the electric car market. Plus, part one of a series exploring Pennsylvania's unequal access to adequate public defense. That's all ahead on The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA.
A classic Honus Wagner baseball card was sold for $2.8 million in September of 2007. The nearly 100-year-old card is one of the most sought-after baseball cards ever. It's estimated less than 200 cards were made because Wagner, the legendary Pittsburgh Pirate, refused to license his image to American Tobacco. This card was bought by Arizona Diamondbacks owner Ken Kendrick, and it previously belonged to the hockey legend Wayne Gretzky. The most expensive version of the card was the Jumbo Wagner, sold at $3.12 million. I'm Mick Stanelli for the Pittsburgh Almanac.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's The Confluence. I'm Kevin Gavin. Above the northern bank of the Allegheny River, overlooking downtown, a group of residents has spent years trying to make their little corner of Pittsburgh a better place to live. 90.5 WESA's Brian Cook has more on Troy Hill Citizens.
Removed from the bustle of the city's busier neighborhoods, Troy Hill is a bit off the beaten path. But looking out from the hillside is a breathtaking view of the Pittsburgh skyline. Family businesses and mid-sized dwellings dot the streets where residents have forged a close-knit community with a small-town feel, a neighborly characteristic that exists thanks in no small part to a group of residents that got together decades ago.
It's just kind of started as the neighborhood nonprofit organization to work between city council with all the different departments of the city, and that people living in the community have someone to go to when they have an issue or have an idea for the community.
That's Patrick Duffy, the vice chair of Troy Hill Citizens, an organization that aims to increase participation in neighborhood programs, develop camaraderie, and beautify the area.
That's a big push for clearing off the steps, for planting flowers along that major entranceway, you know, mulching some areas and planting flowers, planting trees.
Duffy says with its population of about 2,700, it's crucial community members take ownership over how the neighborhood looks and how neighbors interact.
A lot of the time we're looking towards the people power that we have here and not necessarily, you know, relying on the big dollar grants that in the past we may have gotten. But, you know, as funding becomes tighter and tighter, these are harder to get. So I think you do have to rely on being more creative and relying on the people you have to kind of solve the problems that are your own.
One way the group works to strengthen the connection between its residents and the larger community is by encouraging renters to become homeowners. Through its real estate program, Troy Hill Citizens works with the Pittsburgh Community Reinvestment Group to purchase properties, then resell them to buyers. Troy Hill Citizens Chair Sam Morris says a preference is given to existing community members who are currently renting their home.
We're able to get these properties at a very small fee, usually a couple $1,000s, and we're able to sell those to preferably people that are in the neighborhood in order for them to build some equity.
Morris says the program serves a twofold purpose, putting homes in the hands of residents with an interest in keeping up and maintaining their homes, and helping residents who want to put down roots to do so, ensuring the neighborhood a more stable future.
The preference is given to people that live in Troy Hill, that are familiar with Troy Hill, and that are they're contributing to the neighborhood actively. We'd like to be able to, you know, build this kind of internal economy.
For Vice Chair Duffy, the beautification projects and real estate program are examples of what neighbors can do when they simply come together around a common goal. And that by working through Troy Hill Citizens to make the neighborhood more livable, community members are honoring the work of those who came before.
None of this is really possible without all the hard work that's been done before, you know, we got involved. This has been going on since the 1970s to put work back into the community to make this a place that people want to stay, want to live.
I'm Brian Cook, 90.5 WESA News.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. If you're charged with a crime and unable to hire an attorney, you have the right to an adequate defense, and the U.S. Supreme Court has said it's up to the states to make sure that happens. Pennsylvania is the only state that does not allocate state funds for public defenders. Public defense in Pennsylvania remains a patchwork system that can have dire consequences for the most vulnerable people. Keystone Crossroads reporters Emily Previty and Lindsay Lazarski take us to Fayette County to investigate. Lindsay starts us off.
Crystal Weimer was arrested in 2004 for a crime she didn't commit.
Nobody would ever have thought they were going to go to prison or be convicted, you know, especially a murder. Murder charge, like that's bad.
She was accused of killing Curtis Haith, a 21-year-old African-American man who dreamed of becoming a chef. Haith was shot in the face and beaten to death in front of his home in southwestern Pennsylvania. Weimer, a single mom of three young girls, couldn't afford the $50,000 she'd have to pay to a private attorney, so she was represented by a public defender. She says she wasn't too worried about the outcome of the case because she was innocent. She wasn't even in the same town when the murder happened. And after a jailhouse witness was caught in a lie, the charges against her were dismissed.
After I'm out trying to get my life back in order, I had to get another house. I had to get all new furniture, all clothes, everything all over again.
But the ordeal was far from over, just beginning, actually. Something that continues to haunt her to this day.
And then here they come, 5 months later, knocking on my door. Crystal Weimer, come on, it's time. Come with us. Here you go again.
Police arrested Weimer for the same crime, and this time, the charges stuck. Weimer faced up to 30 years in prison for third-degree murder, aggravated assault, and other charges. The prosecutor offered a deal that would set her free in just a few years if she pleaded guilty.
Well, I'm not accepting something I didn't do.
By refusing the plea, Weimer was essentially putting her life in the hands of her public defender. My colleague, Emily Previty, spent most of the past few months digging into that system.
State lawmakers did a report years back based on 2008 data, and it documented the problems with public defense in Pennsylvania. Too much burden on public defenders, zero state oversight of what's happening at the county level, and defendants at the mercy of a very uneven system. After speaking with sources around the state, filing more than 100 right-to-know requests, sorting through thousands of pages of documents, and analyzing dozens of data sets, we realized that the situation hasn't improved and is actually worse in some ways. Even as the crime rate and criminal caseloads have gone down, the burden on public defenders statewide has gotten heavier. In some counties, it's doubled. With the additional cases, overworked public defenders feel even more pressure to wrap things up faster than private attorneys, often with plea deals, and the data backs that up. But Crystal did not take a plea and then sat in Fayette County Jail for 2 years before she went to trial.
2 years. 2 years before I went to court, before I did anything.
At the trial, the prosecutor put on a convincing case with testimony from expert witnesses.
Still, Weimer believed the jury would see that she was innocent. When the jury came back with a guilty verdict, she was in shock.
Is this even real? It was a nightmare or something I couldn't wake up to.
Weimer's conviction potentially could have been avoided if not for what she believes is a major misstep in her case. Remember, Crystal was arrested for Hayes' murder before, and the charges were dismissed. At that time, the Fayette County Public Defender's Office could have tried for a dismissal with prejudice, meaning the charges would have been dropped forever, but that didn't happen.
What do you call it, malpractice? What do you call an attorney that doesn't do their job properly?
We'll never know whether the judge would have agreed to dismiss Crystal's case with prejudice. Fayette County's chief public defender, Jeffrey Whitego, didn't push for that, even though he said he did everything he could. Whitego's been in his position for decades, seeing calls for statewide reform go unanswered, and he seems hardened to the status quo.
I am not going to beat myself up over this. I've been beating myself up for 33 years on this. It's not going to change until the state takes over the system, which I don't see them ever doing. It's not going to be a fair fight.
Public defense in Pennsylvania is truly a scattershot system. Some counties spend thousands of dollars per criminal case, others mere hundreds. Some individual defenders handle a dozen cases a year, others nearly 600 cases. One constant, chief public defenders are paid a fraction of what their counterparts get to head the district attorney's office.
To Whitego, elected officials' campaign is being tough on crime, so it's just not a priority to increase funding for the public defender's office.
If you have an even playing field, there's going to be winners sometimes in the public defender's office even. And that doesn't bode well for anybody, because then the rate goes down as far as the conviction rate.
So the person that's really hurt is the person who's
being represented? Right. But that's a small person in the vast scheme of things.
While in prison, Crystal Weimer wrote letter after letter, by hand, to anyone who would listen. After nearly a decade locked up, one of Weimer's letters landed on the desk of Neelam Sanghvi, legal director at the Pennsylvania Innocence Project in Philadelphia.
The thing that stands out to me the most is just this consistent refrain of, I'm a mom of three girls, I didn't do this, I need to get home.
As Sanghvi and a team of attorneys looked at Weimer's case, it just fell apart. Jailhouse witnesses recanted their stories, soil samples were tossed out of court, and expert testimony was debunked as junk science. The first time around, Weimer's public defender didn't have access to a computer, let alone money to hire investigators and experts to fully disprove all of the testimony that was later thrown out.
How were they supposed to take on all of these complex scientific issues when it's part-time, they have very little funding, there's very little technology?
Crystal Weimer couldn't hire a private lawyer and spent nearly 12 years in prison for a crime she didn't commit. On June 27, 2016, she was exonerated and all charges were dropped, permanently.
If somebody would have investigated this crime from the beginning or had the money to hire a private investigator, this injustice would have never occurred.
Now, Weimer is striving for her life to be normal again. But the lasting effects from being incarcerated make that difficult. She has arthritis in her back from lying on a prison bed and struggles with PTSD and anxiety that she might be ripped away from her family again.
You know, for 12 years of my life, being away from my family and my three little girls, you know, my oldest daughter is still angry at me. Just being without her mom. You can't replace stuff like that. The damage is already done. I can't take it back.
Lindsay Lazarski
and Emily Previty, Keystone Crossroads.
The Keystone Crossroads series, No Justice for All, continues tomorrow on The Confluence. It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. The quality of our urban soil impacts everything from public health to stormwater management to urban agriculture. October 4th and 5th, that's Thursday and Friday, Phipps Conservatory and Botanical Gardens will host researchers, scientists, policymakers, community leaders for the inaugural Three Rivers Urban Soil Symposium to discuss the state of our soil. And now joining us in studio, Gabe Tylove coordinates the Three Rivers Soil Symposium for Phipps, and Jonathan Burgess is the Allegheny County Conservation District Policy Director, and he leads the Urban Agriculture Program. Gentlemen, welcome to The Confluence.
Thanks for being here.
I guess we should start with the basic. Urban soil, is it strictly city confines, or does it go out into the suburbs? What are we talking about?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of times the name can be a little limiting for people, but really urban soils are any soils that are impacted by human development and activity. So housing developments, your small towns, all of the municipalities outside the city, as well as Pittsburgh.
So just to both of you, and we'll start with Gabe this time, just how healthy or unhealthy is our soil in the Pittsburgh region?
So I would say our soil is less healthy than the surrounding areas, the more native soils, but it's pretty similar to other post-industrial cities. So we're not unique compared to Cleveland or Buffalo or these other places, but we do have a lot of compaction. We do have some legacy contamination in our soils, and so we do have some issues to deal with here.
Yeah, I mean, particularly, you know, as we face a changing climate, our own stormwater problems, and just a lot of blight and kind of redevelopment, it's important to think about what's in the soil and how well it's working for us.
All right. Gabe used the term compaction. Why is that important? Why is that maybe an unhealthy factor?
Well, so compaction is important, especially when you're looking at stormwater management issues. You really want stormwater to be able to absorb into soils, but when it's compacted either by low organic matter or by having heavy foot traffic or other traffic all over it, water is more likely to sheet off of it and not settle in. So that's one aspect of a healthy or unhealthy soil is how compacted it is.
Does the health versus unhealthy aspect of the soil, does it vary based on the factors? And I think you alluded to it a little bit, Gabe, about the water runoff, the sheeting of the water. Say public health versus agriculture, or in this case, stormwater runoff.
Well, yeah, one of the nice things about this conversation with urban soils is that no matter where your focus is, a lot of the metrics that define good soil are good across all of those things, whether it's agriculture, stormwater, climate change, sort of low compaction, high organic matter, you know, biodiverse. These things are good just across the board.
So what does good soil look like if we can't analyze it chemically? What can we tell from the appearance?
Yeah, in general, you want it to be sort of dark and loose, something that you can actually put a shovel into and not immediately hit bricks. It also it should smell good, too. Soil smells good.
Soil smells good.
Yeah.
Dare I say that earthy smell?
Yeah, that's it.
Okay. So now why should the average resident care about the quality of soil? John, we'll start with you.
Well, you know, anybody who wants healthy plants growing in their lawn should care. But, you know, as a city, we're about to spend or in the process of spending hundreds of millions of dollars to handle our stormwater issues. Soil is an important component of that. but also kids play in our lawns and our parks. People want their environment to work for them and to also be safe to play around in.
Well, speaking of playing around, and when lead in the water really came to the forefront in the city water a couple years ago, I know officials, health officials, were saying that's great, focus on it, but don't forget about lead elsewhere, including in our soil, where our children play. So children's lead blood levels are affected by that. So how contaminated is our soil, whether it's from lead or are there other contaminants as well?
You know, it's not great. I wouldn't say it's, you know, it's so terrible that we all need to flee our homes and move somewhere else. But, you know, there is a lot of legacy contamination, mostly from old lead paint and gasoline. And the problem in a city like Pittsburgh is we have a lot of homes up against each other. We have a lot of aging homes. And so, you know, that lead flakes off or comes down through air particulates, and it ends up in the dirt around us.
And one thing John said that I think is really important is there is sort of background levels of lead because of, you know, because of old factories, because of lead gasoline from air particulates from that. But also we think about flaking paint. So you might have a lot of your yard is sort of fine, but maybe along an old fence line or along a garage drip line, you might have really elevated levels. And so you might be in sort of a safe area for most of your yard, but in certain areas, you could have very high, very elevated levels. And if your children are playing in that soil, it could be a real risk.
Was that difficult to test for? And is that what you'd recommend, test for those sites right there near a fence, if you have a fence, near a garage, et cetera?
Yeah, it's always, you know, better to test more than less because it does tend to be very localized. So in one spot might not be indicative of the rest of your yard. So, yeah, we definitely encourage testing. And, you know, at the conservation district where I work, we offer free testing events throughout the year. And we make it free because we don't want the number of tests to be a limiting factor for people. More is always better.
So do people sort of dig up, take samples from around different areas and bring it to you, or how's that testing done?
Yeah. So we have some equipment called an XRF unit, and so we're able to take that with us to farmers markets, community events, things like that. We do a little outreach beforehand, and people will bring us their soil, and it'll take about 60 seconds. We'll test it, and we can tell them about lead and arsenic and a couple other metals.
I realize this is a broad question, but I'll ask it anyway. City folks, can we garden in the soil in general?
Absolutely. So it's at Phipps, we're highly encouraging of gardeners. We want everyone to have a backyard patch, but you do need to take some precautions.
And I'm talking veggie garden, especially be stuff that we're going to eat, not just pretty flowers and great shrubs.
So there's a few things that you need to keep in mind. First and foremost, different crops absorb lead at different levels. So if you're going to grow in ground, I would advise against root crops and leafy greens, anything where you're actually eating the leaf of the vegetable. Whereas if you're growing tomatoes, the lead is it won't move into the fruit of the tomato. And so even if you're growing in contaminated soil, you could still eat that tomato and it would be safe. With that said, when you're gardening, you are often digging in the soil with your hands. Mm. And so you do want to make sure that you're washing up afterwards, that you're washing clothes, that your kids aren't eating soil from the garden. But the best thing that we suggest is actually just to garden in raised beds. So if you're in the city, raised beds offer a lot of benefits, both because you can bring in clean soil. You can also bring in a lot of nutrients. So if you go 12 to 16 inches up, and you put a barrier between the bottom of your garden bed and the soil, you can grow anything you want.
Okay. Now, the logical question is, since I mentioned a lot of attention paid to lead in our water, especially city water, is it safe to water those gardens that now you've taken particular care of with a raised bed? Is it safe to water those gardens?
Yeah, definitely. You know, with water, we're talking about parts per billion. So, you know, say when Pittsburgh tested high, you know, water tests would come back at 25 parts per billion. With soil, we're looking at parts per million. So, you know, an order of magnitude difference. So it's definitely safe to water your crops with city water. You might have other issues with regard to pH and other salts and things that are in the water and how those affect your vegetables, but the lead will not be an issue.
Are there regulations in place or even in the works for urban gardens to make sure the soil is rid of contaminants or they're reduced?
Yeah. Well, the city of Pittsburgh has a soil policy.
Okay.
So that kind of is the guiding metric for vacant lots and these types of community gardens and green space projects. And that pretty much mirrors the DEP and EPA standards. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, there are some guidelines out there. You get tested, you do have something to refer to.
Gabe mentioned earlier in our conversation about developments and the compacting of the soil. Are we as citizens impacting the quality of the soil in other ways?
Compaction is one of the primary ones. Industry does continue to be a factor as far as like air particulate deposits, but no, for the most part, we're in the business of improving at this point.
Okay. What about future challenges? I mean, how does the quality of our soil impact future environmental challenges? John?
Yeah, one of the things that we're going to start seeing more, and I think a lot of us who've been outside this summer can certainly attest to, is that rain events are going to start getting more intense. And that's something that's kind of happening around the world as climate shifts for us. So more intense rain means that soil is really going to be tested. So the ability of it to hold water, to stay stable so that we don't have landslides and things on our roads and around our houses, this all gets back to soil quality, the stability of it, how it handles water, how it supports plant growth. So, yeah, going forward, I think it's just only going to get more important for us.
You mentioned something that we just have been really experiencing, the landslide. So we see that the soil can't retain as much water as we would like it to retain. So therefore, the soil, the land lets go, if you would. But the impact of the soil, what it does as not just a retention system, but also a filtering system. Gabe?
Yeah, we really want rainwater to infiltrate through soil because it's gonna clean it, it's gonna cool it, and ultimately that's gonna be the best way for it to get back into the water table and back into our rivers. If it sheets directly over the surface, it brings a lot of erosion and particulate matter with it. It's warmer than it wants to be, and it isn't as clean. So we definitely want water to absorb before getting back into our water system.
All right, we have just about a minute left. I want to ask you bioswales. How important are bioswales? Pittsburgh Water Sewer Authority installed one at the corner of Center and Heron Avenues in the Hill as part of a Green First program. How do they help? Do they help?
Yeah, we're really interested to have some of our guest speakers this week talk about green infrastructure because it is really important. It's a very cost-effective way to handle all that rainwater without just pumping it into a large pipe or sticking it directly in our overloaded storm sewer system. So really those bioswales give a large area for water to flow into and then naturally kind of infiltrate and filter into the soil.
So, Gabe, do you advocate for more? Is it difficult to do? Is it expensive? What, in terms of bioswales and other retention areas?
We think it's a great opportunity for the city to install more or bioswales. In backyard gardens, you can do rain gardens, which there is some price associated with them, but they can be done on a variety of scales. And so rain gardens are a great opportunity for a backyard.
And our final 30 seconds, who's the soil symposium meant for?
Oh, it's meant for anybody that has an interest in the environment that's around them. We are inviting researchers, but it's not just going to be wonky and heavy academic discussions. It's all going to be rooted in practical solutions. So community members, residents, researchers, government officials, everybody's welcome.
And that really represents our planning group. We have an incredible diversity of people putting that together, both from academia, consultants, backyard gardeners, nonprofits, all of that. And so that is reflected in our programming.
The inaugural Three Rivers Urban Soil Symposium is October 4th and 5th at Phipps Conservatory. Gabe Tylove is coordinating the symposium. Jonathan Burgess is the Allegheny County Conservation District Policy Director and leads the Urban Agriculture Program. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
And for today, that is the Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, the Apollo 11 module that went to the moon has landed in Pittsburgh. We'll visit with the Heinz History Center president, Andy Masick, and retired astronaut Jay Apt. And we'll meet the new editor-in-chief of Pittsburgh City Paper, Lisa Cunningham. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.